It's Wednesday, February 1st, and this is Geek Nights. Tonight we'll be covering the controversy surrounding the policy changes for Otakon's Artist Alley.
Let's do this!
Man, I about fell asleep at work today.
I would have if I wasn't at a new office.
Well, I had to sit in a conference call with a bunch of idiots, and I almost fell asleep during it, and I had the phone on my ear, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just, like, I'm kind of ignoring them because I don't really need to babysit them so much, and I started to fall asleep, and then I heard my name in the phone, and for a second I forgot that I was on the phone. I almost just hung it up.
Hilarious.
Yeah, it was great.
I had trouble using the phone today because I don't use the phone at work so much, but today I had to call more people than I've called perhaps in the past year, and people were calling me while I was on the phone in a different line, and I didn't know what to do because I don't know how to use the phone.
I've just been having all the issues with trying to set up doing remote interviews. We thought it'd be so easy. We discovered that Skype is kind of worthless.
Especially with Linux.
Yeah.
And for, well, mostly because of recording. If you don't want to record, it's fine.
Yeah, but if you want to record, even on a good PC, you need two computers, basically.
Yeah. So it's a good thing my work has this nice teleconferencing bridge we're going to use.
Yep, so we'll get to see. And once again, we apologize for the audio quality of the interview bit. That's as good as the cell phones can do. But anyway, in the news, Wired is running a story about people who, using very little technology, track America's spy satellites. And apparently they've been doing this for the last 10, 20 years.
Wait, so were they just looking at it with a telescope?
Yeah, basically the U.S., when they launch a spy satellite, do it kind of surreptitiously. They'll often announce a launch of something, but they'll launch it at a different time or a different trajectory or from a different site. And basically, the entire system of U.S. spy satellites is secured only through obscurity. I mean, the satellites are painted certain colors and designed certain ways to be hard to spot, but obscurity is really the only thing they've got going for them.
You know, if you paint it completely black and non-reflective, you can't really see it because space.
They couldn't do that because it needs to be reflective to reflect things like heat, and it needs solar panels and such.
The solar panels away from the Earth.
Two, more importantly than that, even a completely black object can be seen in space because it stands out from, say, background radiation or other brighter things that it blocks when it passes them. Yeah. So basically, these guys, and they work all over the world, and there's a lot of groups like Heavens Above and CSAT-L are the two mentioned. They just kind of watch for them in the sky, and they all correlate their data. And once they get enough spottings of an individual satellite or an individual object, they can usually do enough math to accurately predict the satellite's trajectory. And they've made big maps of all the spy satellites they've spotted out there. Now, wow. The U.S. doesn't like this so much, and they've been summoned and subpoenaed and told to shut down lots of times, but technically what they're doing is not at all illegal.
No, it's not. And I don't. If a judge said they were guilty of something and there wasn't a new law saying you couldn't do that, I'd be pretty pissed off.
Yeah, well, even the most asinine thing is that, say the government is angry about this, you know, hey, they're telling everyone where our spy satellites are.
So now astronomy will be illegal?
I submit that if a bunch of guys with some pieces of paper and binoculars and some telescopes can do this, I wouldn't put it past the foreign services of every other nation on this earth to do the same thing.
Yeah, the thing is, what do these spy satellites even do? All they can do really is take pictures and transmit data.
Yeah, taking pictures is key. That's how the U.S. does most of its ops when it comes to wartime, at least as far as I know.
Well, yeah, taking pictures is key, but anyone could take freaking pictures. You could take pictures of the spy plane. You could take pictures of anything, you know?
No, spy planes are, you know, they can be shot down. They can be noticed. They're more expensive to use.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I submit to you that a spy plane has more actual security than the spy satellite does if you take away the obscurity. Because a spy plane... All right, the only thing you can really do to a spy plane is maybe shoot it down, right?
Now, like when we got our U-2 shot down.
Right, but you know, they're really, really hard to shoot down, the spy planes, because they go really, really fast and they're really, really high up. So that'll happen sometimes, but well, not often
thing,
enough to from be
From what
dangerous.
I've read, the spy planes we have and all of our stealth bits are only effective against effectively third world nations. And Britain or France or any modern industrialized nation with a real military can just see all of our spy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
We've just never spied on anyone who had the capability to shoot us down or was willing to risk an international incident.
Well, we do spy on them. We spy on them the old-fashioned way with James Bonds and such.
Yeah, we mostly just have satellites.
Yeah. Still, the satellites, anyone can point a dish at them and, you know, collect the encrypted data and then see what it is eventually. It's not really so secure.
They don't care at all about that. They care about people knowing when the satellites are passing over.
Oh, so they don't actually care if someone, you know, knows the useless information of where the satellite is.
Here's the thing. Say you know where the satellite is. All mm-hmm. right. Then you know that spy satellites pass over your country, X, Y, and Z, and there's a period of 3 hours every 4 days where no satellites can see you. That's when you have all the trucks with the uranium drive around.
You know what?
Happened to the U.S. before.
India did it, I think.
Yeah, when they were developing their nuclear program.
You know what?
If
India knows when the spy satellites are coming over, then the spy satellites are pretty much useless. We should stop wasting money on them and stop pestering these guys who see them. I think that's the best idea, because that means they're pretty much useless.
Luckily, the article on Wired, it doesn't seem like they've been pestered a lot recently. So it's because I've known about this for a long time, and it looks like the government's starting to realize that this isn't going to work so well. Either that or it's all a giant conspiracy, and the real spy satellites are actually completely undetectable in magic.
Could be. You know what? I got a better idea. Let's say they're not magic or undetectable. Just put up so many that there's always one passing over everywhere. That way, even if they know where they are, they can't really do anything about it.
Well, China, not too long ago, asserted its right that if it so desired, it could shoot down satellites.
Oh, right, right, right.
But that was in retaliation to the U.S. saying the same thing first.
Yeah, but seriously, shooting down a satellite is not easy. I mean, shooting down a satellite is harder than putting one up.
Well, consider this, though. Putting one up, usually the thing you're putting up is extremely delicate and fragile, and you have to be very careful.
And you
with
have
it.
To use a rocket.
Yes. If you want to knock a satellite out of the sky, you don't need to shoot up a complex piece of equipment. You shoot up a rocket with a weight on it.
Yeah,
and you just ram it into whatever you're shooting up.
Yeah, but the rockets are expensive.
The satellite costs 4 or 5 times more than the rocket.
Really?
If not more.
Well, some satellites cost more. Some satellites are cheap. You know, it depends on the satellite. Like, a TV satellite's kind of expensive.
Keep in mind that...
But just like a camera and a solar cell isn't so expensive.
Keep in mind that even a tiny, tiny glancing blow will just destroy a satellite.
Oh, of course, of course. But the point is that the rocket expense is equal either way. So if I was going to destroy a satellite, I would always, you know, have my rocket expenses and put one up whenever I destroyed one.
Yeah, because you're a rocket scientist.
I could be.
But yeah, I just thought this was cool. And props to these guys for doing this awesome hobby. It's kind of like train spotting, only not as dumb.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, there's this girl named Inga something. I don't know her last name. And I think she was an intern or... Nope, she actually had a job as a legal clerk at a medium-sized intellectual property law firm in Midtown, New York.
All right.
And she wrote an article for the Village Voice called Code Warriors. And it talked all about the free culture movement, specifically the NYU group that, you know, involved in that sort of thing. And, you know, how DRM sucks.
All right, something we can all agree on.
Yep. And she was fired from her job at the IP law firm for holding views contradictory to what the firm does. And it was weird because apparently the firm, like, overemphasized her right to express those views, but then still fired her.
Uh-huh.
It's like, oh, you can keep saying this. We have no problem with that, but you're fired.
See, it's technically, it's a gray area there, but one, they're lawyers. They probably know what they're doing, but it looks like it's technically legal. Because in the United States, at least, and in states that are right-to-work states, which New York is, you can hire and fire some people for any reason at any time with no warning, perfectly legally. The only things you can't discriminate against are protected classes. Things like race, religion, gender.
Sexuality.
Yeah. That one's still hotly debated.
Yeah,
and people
that sucks.
Yeah, because it should be protected.
It should be on the list.
And a lot of other things should be on the list, too, but they aren't.
Yeah.
But anyway.
You know what shouldn't be on the list?
Huh.
Wait. All right, so the point is that however legal this is, it's still... smells real bad.
Yeah, I would definitely call it's one of those situations that I would describe as legal but unethical.
Yeah. There are a lot of things that are legal that are just no good. It's like,
yeah, like all the bribery in Congress. Yeah.
It's like, and the thing is she really wants to be an IP lawyer and she still plans to be one. That's like what she wants to be with her life. And that's, she was working there seriously, but she just happens to have a different view on IP lawyerness. So it's kind of like,
Now, was it for her views on IP itself, or just for her views on DRM specifically? Or
it was because of this article she wrote that was published in the Village Voice that was anti-DRMs.
And all right, now, I submit that an IP law firm would have a vested interest in wanting DRM to go away, because without DRM, the laws are still in place, but now it's a lot easier to infringe, and thus they'll have a lot more business helping companies sue people.
The other thing is, I think the line that got them was, oh, if there's a law, if there are laws I believe are wrong, I will break them. And that's what the girl said in the article. So I'm like, oh, I say the same thing. But apparently lawyers don't like that.
I guess I can understand that.
We can't have any, you know, civilly disobedient lawyers.
There's always that funny poster that's on FARC whenever something like this comes up. It's a picture that says, civil disobedience is still disobedience. It's just a cop beating the hell out of someone. So, my thing of the day, it's not a particularly a new thing, but it amused me to great lengths while I was on that conference call I spoke about earlier at work today. It's an archive of the endings of a whole bunch of video games.
Did they have the ending to Silver Surfer for the NES?
I don't believe I saw it.
Damn.
But I watched the ending to Shadowrun, because as much as I love that game, I don't have, you know, a year of my life to beat it again.
Yeah. All those games that just are not worth it, the endings on the online are pretty good.
And it works really great. It's just a flash site, and it just plays the ending in a loop.
No, not bad.
I don't know what else I can say about it.
Any particularly interesting games in there?
Actually, no. It's pretty much a really generic, there's nothing off the wall or anything.
See, that would have made it really priceless if it was like game endings you've never seen.
No, they were all game endings either I've seen or I don't care about.
That sucks. So, animals doing funny things is pretty much one of the most greatest things you can capture on video.
Yeah, I could say so.
Like,
We're not going to get into it, but we saw a funny animal doing a funny thing at our New Year's party.
Cat attacks kid. cat versus cat.
Yeah.
Dog chasing cat. Yeah, okay. So, two of the best animals are actually in this new video, or semi-recent, or recently discovered. I'm not quite sure. I don't really care. A spider and a snake.
No badgers?
Nope, just a spider and a snake.
All right, and what do they do? Are they lovers?
They fight.
Fight? As into the death?
Yep. And you know who wins?
I'm going to get... Wait, I would guess the snake, but because you asked me, it's got to be fucked up, so I'm going to have to go with the spider.
The spider does indeed beat the snake.
Damn.
Basically, it looks like the snake must have been in a tree or something, I don't know. And it looks like he got caught in the spider's web, which a snake can do if it falls out of a tree. It's a little tiny snake, though. Well, relative to snakes, I'd say it's about a foot long, maybe.
All right.
I don't know. But just a nice little normal snake. And it's like a deadly fucking Black Widow spider, right? And it looks to me like the snake was trapped in the web, and the Black Widow came along and gave it a little poison, a little venom, a little instant complete snake paralyzation. And then it proceeded to web the snake into a little ball, which I guess it later ate.
Yeah, that's what spiders do.
Yeah, so if you have a deadly, deadly spider and a deadly, deadly snake, well, let's just say this. If you have a spider problem, snakes are not your answer.
And I just, for the record, would like to say that my thing of the day yesterday was the Dorodongos, which, as Scott pointed out, I was so incensed in our argument that I kind of didn't even talk about it at all.
So could you say it's your thing of the not day, or...
That wasn't funny at all. I don't know where you're going with
that. Not so much thing of the not.
Nah, you really got nothing. There's not even a joke there. You lost the opportunity.
Well, you were the one who's got nothing.
Yeah, well, you know what? I thought, oh, I'll just talk about it today. And I looked at it again, and I've lost interest completely.
Yeah.
So you're on your own on Dorodongos.
take mud, make a shiny ball. The end.
So as we mentioned at the start, today's show is going to be about Otakon and the, I guess, hullabaloo around their new pending or Artist Alley policy.
For those of you who might not be informed, the policy is referring to the sale and I guess also the display of fan art or, you know, reuse of copyrighted characters from anime and manga in the Artist Alley of Otakon.
Now, basically what happened was, on Wednesday, I believe, in a thread titled Official Changes to Otakon's Artist Alley Policy or something like that.
On the Otakon forums.
Yeah, on the Otakon forums. They made an announcement as to all the changes to the Artist Alley and things like tables are 6 feet wide now and all this other stuff. But tucked away in there, number five, after a large bold thing that says this is the big one, is the following policy. Otakon's Artist Alley will be actively disallowing the sale of unlicensed copyrighted materials. If you own it, you can sell it. If you have a license to it, you can sell it. But if it has material, images, sounds, etc., in whole or in part, in which you do not have permission to sell, then that material will not be allowed in the Artist Alley. Anyone found in violation will lose their space, blah, 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 blah. And then an addendum, the policy for display of unlicensed copyrighted material, provided that it is not for sale, is currently under review.
Now, this is such a big deal because while Artist Alley at Otakon and many other conventions has plenty of original artwork, such as, you know, web comic artists and people making their own print comics and all sorts of other original works of art, much of it and much of the money is in the sale of fan art, which is basically you take existing characters that you did not create and you draw them or write them or whatever into new stories or pictures or whatever.
Now, bear in mind that fan art, while it's a word that we all use, is not a legal definition by any means. And the people who are responsible for this decision, and most of the people in the debate, are very strongly urging that people shouldn't use that word, and they should use more defined terms.
Yeah, I guess fan art could just mean art created by a fan. I mean, you could have a spinning blades somehow making art and, you know, call that fan art.
Now, they made this announcement in the forums, and without much fanfare. And within hours, to put it bluntly, there was a shitstorm on the internet about it.
The shit hit the fan?
Yes, we found out about it because one of our listeners posted a notice about it in our forums, and we saw it, I saw what she posted, and I thought, no way.
At first, I poo-pooed it. I was like, oh, it's just one of those things they have to write. It's not actually a big deal. And then I saw, oh, wait, they're serious.
Now, the thread where they announced it got longer and longer and longer. It got locked a bunch of times. People started flaming each other. There were people who obviously have never been in the forums before who made accounts just so they could post their anger and outrage about it. Mm-hmm. And it started out, and here's the tricky part. It started out that this was announced, and then there's this whole rigmarole. And shortly after that, Anime News Network picked up on it. And all this happened within a thread that's titled Official Changes. Immediately after the Anime News Network article picked it up, the Jim Vowles, the head of Otakon, posted in the forum of Anime News Network clarifying that it's not, in fact, a done deal, and it's not an official change, and it's all pending.
All right. That's kind of fishy.
So we're not sure exactly what's going on at this point, but we have a lot of quotes from various staffers about the issue.
And we have a special guest to help us.
Yes, indeed. So, without further ado, you might remember him from his famous politics and anime panel at Otakon, and his upcoming otaku romance panel at Anime Boston, and many people know him as the Jewish Wolfwood. We've got Mike Pfeffer here with us.
So, it's good to have you on the show.
Well, thanks. Great to be here. You know, real honor. I've never done anything like this, so I'm still kind of, wow, somebody actually wants me around. I'm not throwing myself upon them. Woo!
Well, I gotta say, I mean, we saw you did a cosplay way back, and it was awesome. And then we saw you when you did your politics and anime panel at Otakon. And I gotta say, it was a really well-done panel, and we were impressed.
Thank you. You know, that's actually something I just did for fun most of the time. I mean, my senior thesis, you know, I was a political science major. I did it on East Asian international relations. And the fact that I had, like, four slides on that one manga that nobody had ever heard of, Kuniga Moeru, was because it dealt with my thesis topic, and I was just hammering that down, yet nobody knew what the hell I was talking about. So it was just kind of like a logical extension, you know?
Yeah, I remember at that panel I was expecting you to talk about Sanctuary, and then at the end some other guy yelled out and recommended it. Did you ever actually get around to finding it or reading it? Or?
Oh, my God. After that panel, I had about 20 people corral me, and I had no clue about what to do next, so I didn't have a chance to write down too much. But,
yeah,
pinch out of that.
Yeah, there's a terrific manga called Sanctuary. It's about a mafia guy and a guy trying to be the prime minister working together.
Is that the one that's all black with the guy with the cover? I know exactly what you're talking about. I can't find that anywhere, man. I can't find it.
I've got all of it, and I've got all of Eagle. So maybe I'll lend it to you sometime. You don't live far away.
Oh, my God. That would make my day. I mean,
yeah, yeah, also, if you said you can go, you would go to New York City easily. If you go to Midtown Comics, they have all of it. That's where I got all of it.
You know, I think I've probably been there a couple times. I mean, I went with my.
They have two branches. One branch is near Times Square, and one is on Lexington near Grand Central.
I think I've probably been to the one near Times Square. I think I might have just been there like once or twice back then. I was just trying to find the original Nadesco novel, the large print one. This is before the was it before they reissued it, and I was like looking everywhere. Nobody knew anything about it. These guys had Volume One, which made
yeah, they have everything there. But I think you'll have, if you go to the Lexington branch, I'm pretty sure you'll have good luck finding volumes of Sanctuary. All of it, if not at least a good portion.
Excellent. I always like to try just, you know, hunting, you know, to get my hands on it before I resort to the internet, because that's like, you know, using a cheat code if you just got to find it online.
Yeah, I know.
Google.
Know exactly what you're talking about.
But basically, we've already introduced the topic at hand, the Otakon Artist Alley issue. And considering that we saw you in the community about it, and we know you to be generally articulate and interesting, we figured you would be a good person to ask about this.
Okay.
So tell us a bit about this Save Artist Alley LiveJournal community.
Well, before I begin, I just want to state that most of this is just coming from my personal opinion, you know, just the standard disclaimer stuff. I am not an Otakon staffer. I have never been part of the running of Otakon, blah, blah, blah. Not a law student nor an artist, just, you know, concerned Joe citizen here. But from my understanding, the community that we formed, Save Artists Alley, is a community dedicated to getting people involved with returning Artists Alley to what we've known it to be, a place where people can gather and show what they've created, any creative works that might represent any sort of anime, manga, video game, any sort of topic or property they care to present. And we're centered around the idea that, and this is just roughly me quoting since I'm not really in charge of the community or anything, we're centered around the idea that the spirit of the law is conflicting with the letter of the law, and Otakon is taking overzealous steps in order to preserve the letter. Now, we feel mostly, and I'm not sure if there's any real single line that anybody's trying on here, but I think that what we're really going for is the idea that fan art, as an institution, as a creative work, is a protected form of expression. I could draw a parallel for you. What this would go on with would be, let's say, I'm an artist, and as part of my, you know, education, I paint a copy of Van Gogh's Starry Night, you know, the famous painting, right? Now, let's say I paint this, and it's a good replica, and somebody is interested in buying it. And it is clearly marked Starry Night, as interpreted by Mike Pfeffer, you know, $10. So they give me the $10, you know, I give them the painting. I've just made money off of Vincent Van Gogh. And is Vincent Van Gogh going to sue me? Can he sue me? Or his estate? Can his legal representatives collect damages or criminal penalties from me for doing this? I say that with American copyright law, and to a lesser extent, international treaty, does not cover this effectively to the point where Otakon needs to take such draconian measures in order to enforce their policy. Now,
well, I can say that I've got a large compilation of various quotes from staffers on this before, because Jim Volz, the head of Otakon, pretty much put a moratorium on the staff commenting on this issue in light of the, well, flame wars that have appeared on their forums.
Yeah,
but it appears...
I mean, you know, when you think about it, Jim Volz is really just trying to do some effective damage control. I don't think he's involved.
Oh, yes. I definitely don't blame him for what he did, because honestly, their forums exploded, and Anime News Network reported on it, and then he corrected them when they apparently made a mistake. But apparently, as far as I can tell, and this is based on my analysis of the things the staff has said, they have not stated to me directly what has happened, but there's no legal pressure. There's been no, like a lot of people have speculated that maybe one of the anime companies cracked down on them, or maybe the dealers are complaining about competition. But Rach Land, who's the head of Artist Alley, said, and I quote here, when she was asked why this suddenly became an issue after 10 years of it being a non-issue, quote, "I'll take the blame credit for that. It was my decision to act on this for Otakon 2006, and I thank El Presidente and the Otakon staff for supporting me."
Okay, I remember seeing that quote, and I also remember some of the surroundings, some of the actual other things she said concerning that. You know, just to paraphrase Rach Land, and I have nothing against her, I don't know who she is, I've never met her before, apparently she encountered some sort of violation of an intellectual property that she herself had created. I think it was some
that
sort
is
of
correct.
Some play or puppet show. Now, I understand that if she's coming from a perspective of a chairperson in charge of a department, let's say, just to back into more organizational terms, if she, acting as a chair of the department, had some sort of input in order to formulate a better policy, and this is just, you know, how to craft something together, I think that what might have happened here was that she used this policy as a little bit of an overzealous personal example. Now, this is not something that you need to rule out entirely, don't get me wrong. Personal experience can help a great deal in making policy, in making rules and regulations, even for an organization like Oticon. However, I think that what might have happened, and I really would have loved to see the minutes, the logs of that meeting where this policy was formulated, I think what happened was just a battle of, here is what could happen, here's where I'm coming from as a creator, here's how I feel, and here's what we need to do to take steps against that. And when
and for what I see, that seems like it's a very good idea as what happened. I mean, looking at the conversations that took place before Jim Volos kind of stepped in and started speaking for Oticon, Rachel Ann very specifically clarified the policy and did clarify it to be a very draconian thing. She said that chibi art would not be okay because it's not considered parody. She said specifically that yaoi of characters is not parody but rather exploitation of a licensed copyright character and will not be allowed.
I see. You know, that's where... Now, I just want to state that I'm not a yaoi fan, and, you know, believe me, my little talk today is going to be full of disclaimers.
Neither are we.
Yeah.
But, we're fans of making fun of yaoi, not actually enjoying it.
Exactly, you know, but to each their own, I say, and if it's going to be a form of exploitation, then they're going to have to define the exploitation that's happening here. If somebody wants to draw, as horrible as I feel using this example, you know, Ed Al Yaoi, come on, that's not going to be great. It's not really my cup of tea. But
oh, I've seen worse. Have you read Death Note?
Oh, I've heard of it, and believe me, I've heard. I go on image boards, man. I know about half of the yaoi that goes on throughout the entire internet.
Oh, man.
It's horrible. And yeah. It's out there. And it is used, and it does fall back under the same thing. Even if you're drawing just Ed Al hanging out, you know, getting his automail fixed, if something's going on, that is part of an intellectual property. Even if it's not yaoi, it's still under Rachel Ann's definition of the phrase exploitation. If you want to go into a dictionary definition of exploitation, it's going to fall under a very different flock of geese here. We're not exploiting. This is basically expression that's really coming into question. How does an artist express themselves with an established object? How does an artist bring this about? And there's a lot of legal definitions that I'm not sure have fully been addressed here. I'd like to hear what the Oticon legal staff has to say about this. But there really is.
Yeah, I was very... when at first I thought that, you know, this might have been something the Oticon lawyers had come up with and told them to implement. But then, you know, when you notice they didn't do anything about the cosplay or the AMVs, I said, oh, maybe they didn't. And it turns out that as of now, they haven't actually talked to the lawyers yet.
Yes, well, apparently the lawyer was sick, and he had a horrible flu for, like, the past week, and that's the only reason he hasn't reviewed this policy. But regarding the anime music videos and the cosplay, I do know that Oticon pays ASCAP license fees or something along those lines in order to be able to use the music for the AMVs, and they get the blessing of the industry to show them. And as for the cosplay, their insurance policy, as far as my understanding goes, once again, I'm not Oticon staff either, their insurance policy covers public performances of arts. And selling an art is not considered a public performance. It's considered a paid performance or a paid whatchacallit. So there's not legal covering for the other two. But when it comes to Artist Alley, I actually pointed out to them, and Rachel Ann actually thought about it, and she's considering asking the lawyer about it, that by actively pursuing a policy of cracking down on copyright law, Oticon is actually opening itself up to liability as opposed to closing it.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's also the issue that in Artist Alley, they're selling things to profit. You know, you've got fan art, and you're trying to make money off of it, whereas the AMVs and the cosplays is just, you know, entertainment value. You're not actually selling anything to make money.
Well, that's true, and I do think that it is necessary for copyright holders to act on that infringement, but, however, that's in the hands of the copyright holder to engage in. I mean, for example, I heard this is completely anecdotal. I could be way off base or even completely wrong. At Katsu 05, and I know at Otakon 04, there was a table in the artist alley that was selling hats, you know, handmade little hats, and among those hats were interpretations of characters from FMA. You know, he had a little... an Ed and Al hat, you know. It was cute if you like that sort of thing. Funimation found out about this, and they had the person who was making them cease and desist, but in another wonderful twist of fate that could just be internet lies or complete utter truth, I think that Vic Mignogna himself will put in an order for a couple of hats, you know, just a personal commission from the artist. And this could be completely wrong, but in this case, you know, I don't see this, you know, the Artist Alley, and I could be legally incorrect, I don't see Artist Alley as a public performance. I don't really see it as an art presentation. I don't see it as a viewing of artworks. I see more of a commercial enterprise, but in this commercial enterprise, when you're dealing with something that is not necessarily the exact item that is under copyright protection, that is where the big question comes up. Is fan art an actual commercial profit off of an intellectual property, or is it simply an interpretation of an intellectual property as viewed through the eyes of artist X? And when you take away that interpretation, when you take away that ability to create and then to distribute that creativity, and yes, we're talking about for money here, but we are talking about for works by artist X, not by Funimation, not by ATV Films. Yes, they own the copyright, but are they selling copies of the DVD? Are they selling cells that were made in the animation? Are they selling official merchandise that's been bootlegged? What I think this new policy is doing is equating the bootlegged anime that we see in the dealer's room to fan art, to individually created works of art. I mean, even if we're just talking, just last year I got a pin of Haro from Gundam Seed, which I think is totally awesome. And this
is totally awesome.
I bought a little one, washcloth for my girlfriend, and she loved it.
Oh, yeah. Those are just totally great. And here you have just an individual piece of creative art. This is a button. This is a pin. Somebody with a pin press sat down and made this. It's got Haro on it. Yes. Is Bandai making this? No. Is it being marketed anywhere? No. Is this a Bandai product that is produced under license from Bandai, under their sole control to distribute as they see fit? No. Is this something that one person sat down and made? Is this something that one person has interpreted from their intellectual property? Yes. Is it harming Bandai by producing this, which they do not have any production of or verifiable interest in? As far as we can tell, no, it does not harm the individual company. And
now, on that point, I agree with you. And I guess that kind of shows the point that, I mean, this is a very legal gray area, like as you elaborated. And I feel that it's not Otakon's place to try to enforce it, but Otakon should obviously comply if a dealer or a producer actually wants to stop someone and they have the legal right to do so, then they can deal with it on their own. Otakon should help them. But I don't think Otakon should be enforcing a policy on their own.
Exactly. I mean, look at the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. This is big news for, you know, a lot of tech people. And it hits every now and then. There's some big bust that involves an ISP having to turn over server logs to somebody that's using Kazaa or something else like that. You know, oh my God, they're still using the old version of Napster. Knows. Well, what happens with the DMCA is that the government or the complainant in the party has to deliver a subpoena. They have to get on the record and put in the complaint to the ISP, who then provides the logs. The ISPs are not responsible for patrolling these networks, although most of them do, just on their own. They are not responsible for handing things over. I mean,
yes,
like,
and in fact, that is the liability I was speaking about when I talked about Otakon opening themselves up. ISPs have common carrier status, meaning that they are not actually responsible for what goes over their wires. However, if they choose at any time to actually invoke control over what goes over the wires, they've now legally opened themselves up to the fact that they can be held responsible for failing to act in a specific situation because they've shown that they can act. And by Otakon actively enforcing this, they're saying that they can act, and thus they can be held legally culpable if they do not act, which I could see them not acting if there's 8 staffers trying to police 300 artists.
Well, I think that even with just those 8 staffers, they can at least do something if they are forced to do so, if they're subpoenaed, if they are legally given a cease and desist. That's part of the process. That's why a company cannot just march in and say, hey, you're being sued for distributing this without a, and they're not properly warning the artist. Let's say ADV doesn't like the fact that I'm selling Excel Saga, what sort of Excel Saga merchandise can I think of? Excel Saga lunchboxes. They don't
Menchie
have
grills.
Saga lunchboxes, for fresh Menchie involved. But I don't think they have any on their sale roster. And if they don't, what if I want to make them? And they just march in and say, no, you can't do this, you're being sued. Here I am saying, whoa, I didn't know you had an interest in this. I know you own Excel Saga, yeah, but you don't own any Excel Saga lunchboxes. Without any sort of proper oversight, then ADB can just handle it down no matter what. And, I like ADB. Dave Williams is a good guy, for coming out to cons and doing all this good stuff, despite what I have against their voice actors at some points, but that's another podcast entirely.
Yes. So here's a question for you. Suppose the policy goes into play as it is written now. What do you think will be the effect on Artist Alley this year?
Well, for one thing, the spirit is going to be different. I can't really say about the actual numbers, but it's going to be fundamentally altered. I say, for one thing, that we're talking with First Amendment territory here, wherein the right to express is being basically taken down, and how many otaku have the funds to fight this? How many people have the time and effort to do so, even more? If you just walk into Artist Alley and you have, I always perennially think of just the kid who's 14, 15 years old, no real resources, finally managed to come to his first Otakon, and he or she wants to pick up his or her favorite just drawing of character. They like Winry. They want their Winry drawing, and it's not there. You can't buy this. You cannot go into this one area where individual artists who get no real exposure in any other mass form, unless you go around DeviantArt for fun, they don't really have the chance to market their wares, to show their skills in a way that's applicable to otaku. They are some incredibly talented artists down in the alley. There's this one guy who I idolize. He does fantastic mecha drawings. I bought a signed print from him of an arm sleeve from Full Metal Panic. I fully intend to get when he starts doing some Gundam Seed work, And what if he's not there? What if he's just drawing, generic Mechabot 2000? That's all well and good, but I don't want generic Mechabot 2000. I want my fucking arm sleeve,
Yeah. Well, I looked through my pile of art that I bought for the last 4 years at Otakon, and there's a bunch of dozens and dozens of little prints and crap I bought. And of all of them, not a single one didn't include licensed characters in some pseudo-legal way.
Exactly. And what that does in spirit, we'll get on to practicality in a second. In spirit, that takes away the entire reason for having an artist alley, for having a gathering of people. That the whole purpose of a convention is to gather with like-minded people. It's not really to go and attend panels. Yeah, you can do that, but isn't the real purpose of being here to do something you normally can't, to be an otaku amongst otaku, to be amongst your own people? And yet here we are in a state where our own people are being repressed from within. I hate using words like that, but it's no less true. The powers that be have taken it upon themselves to impose restrictions on something that they are supposed to be supporting and defending. I'm not saying that it is our fundamental right for an artist alley, but as part of Otakon, it's integral. It's like trying to live without a liver. You can do it, but it ain't going to be fun.
Well, I guess since we want to wrap this up at some point, I'd like to ask again regarding the Save Artist Alley LiveJournal community. What can we do? What can concerned fans who want to express civilly their disagreement with Otakon's policy or any sort of disagreement with this in general, what can they do? What is Save Artist Alley doing?
Well, first of all, Save Artist Alley has a couple of things going at this time. We are trying to get together a sort of modus operandi, who we are, what we really want to do, and how we're going to go about it. I suggested a couple of things, including, first off, trying to engage Otakorp Incorporated as paying members. When you sign up for Otakon, you're not just signing up for an event. Under the regulations of the Baltimore Convention Center, we are members of Otakorp. We are coming for a big meeting, and as shareholders, if you want to use that term, we have a right to understand what's going on with our board of directors, and we have a right to make changes, appeals, etc., as we see fit. What I want them to see with Save Artist Alley is an organized, rational place where people can come together and assess their own abilities to put pressure on Otakorp, on the board of directors, on the Artist Alley people, in order to effect the change to restore Artist Alley to the state that it was in before this all came down. What we're doing is setting up a single point of contact. There's nothing really concrete as of yet, but we are getting petitions going. We are even considering contacting the public relations groups for the industry in case this does come to it. Last thing we want to do is call down thunder upon ourselves, but it's a good, if it comes to it, we may very well need to go up to Funimation, ADV, Genion, and say, hey, we would like for you to grant a license for anyone in this area of Otakon to make use of your intellectual property in the way that we see fit as artists. Well, we will engage the following conditions. You know, we won't sell any of your stuff. We're just going to do our own drawings, et cetera, et cetera. If necessary, Save Artist Valley will become, and this is what I hope against, it will become a bulwark where people can gather and actively put pressure on the powers that be. I like Jim Bowles. I like what he's doing to at least get things in line. I don't believe he had anything to do with this policy decision. And I believe what he can do is understand that we are your people, Jim. We are the ones that want to put money in this con's pockets. We want to keep it strong. We want to keep it fun. And we want to keep it the way it's been, because there's not been any reason to change.
A speech truly befitting of a member of the Communist Party of Anime.
Viva la Revolución, comrade.
Yeah. So on that note, I'll say to all of our listeners out there that we are going to put a link to the Save Artist Alley Live Journal community in today's post. And thank you, Mike, for being here with us.
Guys, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, now that the audio quality is back to normal, I'd like to thank Mike for being with us. I thought that was a very interesting interview, and we'd like to have him on the show again.
Yeah, that went a lot better than I could have possibly imagined.
Yeah, it's actually, for all of you who have never tried this, it's very difficult to have a conversation with more than two people over a phone, because there's just so little audio bandwidth. It's really hard to hear when someone's talking or interrupting, and it was kind of a challenge for us.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have even been possible without the use of the teleconferencing bridge that my company owns.
Oh,
it's very cool and has a web interface and all kinds of other cool stuff.
Yep. Though in the long run, we'll look into better ways. Like, if we ever interview Mike again, he doesn't live that far from us, so we'll go do it live.
Yeah, and maybe if we call the bridge with Skype and microphones instead of using everyone on their cell phone, it could work out a lot better.
Yeah, you can hear, I filtered what we did heavily, but my phone clips my voice out a lot harsher than his phone does. I guess it speaks for the quality of a good cell phone.
Yeah, the raw recording was Rim real loud, Scott real loud, Mike real quiet. And
yeah.
In the original recording, Mike sounded real good and we sounded like ass.
So we still sound like ass, but at least it's quiet ass now and you can actually hear what Mike's saying.
Yeah, that's what's important, because he was far more interesting than either of us.
Yeah, though we have some just final thoughts here and some bits that we wanted to talk about in some detail that would probably require you actually being able to hear my voice. But we're not sure where this is going to go with Otakon. I mean, this is all preliminary and it exploded. And Jim made a statement very recently, I think it was this morning, saying that basically this is the end, no more debate, stop talking about it, we're going to release the official Otakon policy soon and then you can debate it.
Mm-hmm.
And the post, I'm not going to read the whole thing, it's kind of long. But he starts out by saying that Rachel Ann and I have both admitted that the way things were initially presented was confusing. Clearly, a lot of people misread it. If we had to do it over again, we'd have done it differently.
I don't know. I think they did some pretty good clarifications along the way.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. He says, and I no offense to him. I think he's an awesome guy. But we are not banning all fan art at Otakon, not even within the Artist Alley, period. And another staff member, JK, the treasurer, says Otakon is not banning fan art. And Rachel Ann, actually, in one of her later posts, says that basically she says that the rule was put in place to, you know, so they can say that's the rule, legal, whatever. But wink, wink, nudge, nudge, it's only going to be enforced for egregious offenders. If you look in the threads, I don't want to really read all the quotes from her I have that support this, but that's what she basically said. She listed 11... I guess, things that are more important than enforcing this rule. And then she said, well, we officially have to enforce copyright trademark laws. Remember, I have to say this, and this will probably give you an idea of, give you an idea of where we'll be focused in terms of what we're going to enforce.
That sounds like a change of tune, because if you read the early posts, I mean, sure, okay, I can understand that. Her saying that if the only place that they said no fan art was the original statement. But she went on in multiple posts afterwards saying all kinds of things.
Yes. I mean, here she clarified what would be allowed. Here's one. Say I have placed a character in a different pose, background, situation than he would be found elsewhere. Not allowed. images copied directly from another source, not allowed. Just a list of things that are specifically not allowed.
Now, if your stance was actually that you just had to say this and you weren't actually going to enforce it and you just had to say it, then why would you have clarified with a specific list of things that are not allowed, including the things you said you weren't going to enforce? You would only have written that in the original and public policy and not in many, many private messages in the forums.
Another one, chibis would not be allowed. They wouldn't be considered parody. So if I take a character and draw them all cute, it says specifically that would not be allowed.
Mm-hmm.
The Yaoi thing, like I mentioned, we were talking to Mike. Yaoi is not parody, but rather exploitation of a licensed copyrighted character.
So now, you know what?
Be
I actually wouldn't mind if there was some sort of no Yaoi rule. Or
yeah.
At least some sort of Yaoi restriction. A Yaoi restriction, I think, would be good.
Well, how about just a Yaoi section? Like, have an area of Artist Alley where you can say, my art is explicit, I would like to be there. Don't make it, like, don't enforce it as a rule, but make it an option.
Because, yeah,
I mean, Yaoi people and the people who are into it, they're usually really cool people, and they would probably want to put themselves in the Yaoi section, if for nothing else, so the fangirls can find them.
In the art auction, they put the nasty stuff behind the barriers, hidden away, right? Why don't they put the people with, you know, the Artist Alley tables that have that sort of thing in a different section behind some walls or something like that, you know? It's like they're in with everyone else. I'll be looking through people's art books, and I'll be like, yay, yay, oh, God, oh, God. And that's right next to someone who's, like, got cute thingies for kitties, you know? They should separate the tables as well as the auction, I think. That would be an okay policy that I could live with. Yeah, I think they're actually... They're being smart now that they realize they messed up, and I think they're going to go ask the lawyer, and then that'll be that, whatever the lawyer says.
Yep. So I wouldn't be surprised if this policy gets reworded or completely thrown out or something, because honestly, it's my opinion that if Otakon goes forward with this as it's written or in a similar form to as it's written, Artist Alley is not really going to exist as in a form that I really care about anymore. So I guess the last thing I have to say here is that this is going to be an ongoing debate, and as I request in the forums, if any of you have anything to say about this, please send us audio feedback, email, post in the forum, something. We're going to do another episode on this where we'll take comments from anyone who's involved. We want to get some comments from the Otakon staff if they have anything to say, from any artists out there. We really just want to hear what you have to say about this. And that was Geek Nights with Rim and Scott. Special thanks to DJ Pretzel for our opening theme.
Be sure to visit our website at www.frontrowcrew.com. If you like our podcasts, you'll love our forums. Make sure you visit them. You can send your email feedback to geeknights@gmail.com. And if you want, you can leave us a voicemail at 206-333-1537.
Geek Nights airs every weeknight, Monday through Thursday.
Geek Nights is recorded with absolutely no studio and no audience. But unlike those other talk shows, it's actually recorded at night.